arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Did you find that interesting last night? The teaching I received when I went to Vancouver is called Lamdre. Sometimes it's called the Three Visions. It's the impure vision of subject-object, the vision of experience, and pure vision. The idea behind it is that in order for there to be any manifestation, there's craving. Have you noticed that?
Yes.
There's this craving, isn't there? And sometimes it's without any particular object, it's just sort of a low-lying angst kind of dissatisfactoriness. Do you think that's true in your life? And then eventually, almost as a relief, you image an object. Well, that's going to do it for me, or that's going to do it for me. Have you ever felt yourself do that? And in the process of doing that, do you find that repetitive patterns seem to arise? Mm-hmm. Oh, it must be a relationship. Oh, it must be this. Oh, it must be that. The repetitive patterns arise because you think that in order to get something, we have to act a certain way. Right? Which is only reasonable. And by how we act, we can see what it is, how we are reaching. By the result of how we act. If we keep getting the same pattern arising, am I making sense?
Yes.
Then by being aware after a while, gee, there's something really familiar about this pattern. Right? And then rather than going to despair, which we usually do, I only did it, you know, 10 or 20 or 5,000 times, but sometimes people are a lot smarter than I was. By going into that and just looking at it and saying, well, why is this what's happening? This is a real beginning of wisdom here. Why, when I'm trying to, does this happen again? Why does he, she betray me? Why do they not understand I was telling the truth? Why, right? Does this sound familiar? Well, you get to that point. And that is when in Buddhism, in the Tibetan tradition, in Vajrayana, they call mirror-like wisdom. The beauty of this world and our existence is that there is always craving, one is always trying to satisfy it, and the way one tries to satisfy it reflects back one's own partial view. So everything you do becomes your teacher. Isn't that beautiful? If you have the ability to not go into that kind of self-remorse, guilt, thinking right or wrong, but you're curious, oh. And it's mirror-like because when you're trying for something, usually it disappears. When you're not trying for something, usually it comes right in your face. Have you noticed? So, the first level of vision, the impure vision of subject-object, is when you just think, oh, well, this is what I want, therefore I'm going to directly get it. And then you get what you want. I have a friend who recently sold his business for a vast amount of money. He isn't 40 years old yet. He worked very hard. He's what you would call a workaholic. His family vaguely remember what he looks like, vaguely. Mm-hmm. They have a picture of him on the mantle so they can go and check. Oh yeah, that's Dad. Because he was determined to be able to get to the top of his field, which he did, that he sold his business. Then everyone around him is telling him how he's got it made. But that's not how he feels. And any of us ever finally got the job, the place, the relationship, the circumstance, and then said, you know, it hasn't just quite measured up. So that's why it's called the impure vision of subject-object. If I get that, then the craving will go away. It's impure, because it's not true. You have a question?
No.
It's funny how long it takes us to get that, isn't it? We really think if we're good, bad, right, wrong, put on a good front, put on a bad front, ta-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. There's 1,001 of them, aren't there? Ignore it, whatever. But that craving is still there. So pure vision is when you know that nothing, that the eight worldly dharmas are not pure vision. The vision of experience is when you know that the eight worldly dharmas are not going to satisfy you. And you begin to follow a spiritual quest. So what you have done is you have traded off the object of the material world. You have traded one illusory goal for another illusory goal. But this illusory goal, this second illusory goal, is a little more wholesome. Because it doesn't put you in conflict with other people or other beings, does it? A spiritual goal? Does it put you in conflict with other beings? It does? How does it do that?
Well, one gets into sectarianism.
He said if one gets into sectarianism.
Okay.
But that means thinking that I'm right. So that has more to do with wanting, in my mind, that has more to do with thinking, changing it from a spiritual goal to a physical power over others, being right. To me, being right is a way of having power. So I don't see that as not being attached to the eight worldly ideals. Would you accept that?
Yes.
Yeah. So there can be, that can accompany any spiritual search, and will. We always like prefer to think we're right, don't we? I mean, why would we do it? Oh, I know this is wrong, therefore I'm going to do it. No, I don't think so. But it's close, isn't it? But that is pretty well always there. That's more clinging to a sense of self than it is. But if you want to have a true understanding, say, of whatever your God sense is, you wouldn't be looking... You wouldn't be trying to get somebody else to work for you, or, you know, stealing somebody else's wife, or would you? Not basically. So what you have done with this second vision is that you have actually made your illusion that you're, because it's still an illusory thing. You don't know whether it's possible to get craving or not. You've never actually just explored the craving at this point, right? You have just given up on physically satisfying it. That's straightforward. Everybody following me here? So you don't know whether a spiritual value will actually supply you with what you want. But it is a better choice because you don't have to do as much income tax. You don't have to have as many appointments. Is that true? Your life is less complicated. It becomes more simplified. You're not spending so much trying to maintain a whole outer experience. And every once in a while, due to the mantra that you are saying, whatever it is, Hail Mary, full of grace, blessed art thou amongst women, blessed is the fruit of thy womb, right? Whatever it is you're saying, Kaddish, whatever it is you're saying, Buddhist prayers, Christian prayers, Muslim prayers, whatever it is you're saying, then there begins to be, with every word, there begins to be a sense that that could be true, that could be real. Is that true? Mm-hmm. Do you all know that? That mantra work? Do you all know that? There is one of you in this room that was absolutely shocked to find out that when they did Manjushri, their mind became sharper. All those deity yogas, they actually work. They found that people were saying they were too sharp. Well, more than one of you have done this, but I'm just going to pick on one of you tonight. Carefully without looking at you. And so you change your thoughts and your reality changes, doesn't it? You've all experienced that, have you? Some of you are not going to answer. Can you hear me? This is question and answer night, so it's actually a discussion. So then, because you're not putting yourself in such an unwholesome state of being in competition for physical, material objects, you have a little more time to relax and be present in the world and notice things as they are. When you're more present, notice things as they are when flights are delayed, and you actually just have time. You start feeling more at ease with how things are unfolding and less having to make something happen. Is that true?
Yes.
When you find that starts happening, there is a greater sense of interest and just easiness in your normal state of life. A more wholesome mind state arises called devotion. It's more easy for you to feel happy. Do you understand that? When it's more easy for you to feel happy and you are repeating one formula over and over, It's more likely that out of the corner of your eye one day, from the flash of light on a magpie's wing, you will suddenly see Yamantaka, that meditation that you've been doing, all of a sudden arise in the light. You'll have a full experience of it. Your body will have a whole energy experience. And then you will have had what's called the vision of experience. Which is also an illusion, but it's a cut higher. Because you notice that in all the deity work, that after you manifest the deity, what do? Any of you done any deity yoga? Pardon?
You dissolve it.
So you spend time over and over again teaching the mind to come to one point. What does craving do before you teach the mind to come to one point?
Causes
the mind to go all over the place. So the first thing you do is you bring the consciousness to stop trying to satisfy craving on the material realm. That doesn't mean you stop eating or stop paying your bills. It means you do as much as you need to and not more. Right? And then the rest of your time, you begin to make choices that are more in, for your craving or for whatever, more in line with a spiritual practice, whatever the spiritual practice may be. Most religions stop at that point. Do you think that's true? At the point of imaging and making a choice for an object that is spiritual. If you just believe in such and such, everything will be all right. Do you see that? And in fact, if people have enough wholesomeness in their life or the desire for wholesomeness and repeat the words, they will have a vision of experience. It will be profound. It will be true. It can happen at the deathbed. They can suddenly recover all their health. Miracles can occur. There is nothing the least bit out of line with that. Where we go with Buddhism, however, is we take one more step. We say there is also the true vision, which has more to do with having concentrated the mind, able to see a deity with a sense, having put the focus on the spiritual. If you're going to always be after an illusory goal to get rid of the craving, at least pick a, you know, a, some kind of angel as your elusive goal, you know, something a little more fun, something that will have more power for your heart, because you know you can never satisfy your body. You can ease it for any one moment, and you should. You don't torture it. But then having established that vision of, okay, I'm going after a spiritual, and gone after it, and noticed that so many other things, because you're not chasing around trying to get everything out, all the other ducks in a row, isn't that a funny thing? All the other ducks in a row, you know, and so like the ducks can fly wherever they want to, and they row up when they want to, and it's no problem. And you can just focus on what your main focus is, and you just keep doing that and doing that. The mind gradually becomes more and more one-pointed, and you gradually are able to use the mirror-like wisdom of that to go into greater and greater depth. Right? Now the mirror is a very beautiful mirror. It's called love, or it's called understanding, or it's called compassion, or it's called discrimination. And so as you're moving toward that, that mirror reflects back that and what you are doing toward it, and you naturally begin to have insight and Things begin to go more smoothly and you begin to have more joy. And meanwhile, your mind gets more and more concentrated on the detail of your practice. Until one day, your mind is so concentrated that no matter where you put it, you can sit in a state of calm, abiding. And the mind is not all over the place. There is devotion, there is interest, there is concentration, there is interest. At that point, a question will naturally arise. What is reality? At that point, having done this training, suddenly that door will open. Because the mind is now naturally able to focus, because you've done it over, 100,000 times, this one, that one you need to do 1,000,000 times. Oh, you've done it 1,000,000, I think you should do it 10,000,000 times. Right? If you also know something of the process, it makes it more powerful. So do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
In your precious human birth text, there's this phrase, training consciousness to cherish others more than oneself. Does that have, like, you're coming up against who is training this? Who is it that's training the mind to my point? What is, if I'm not my body, I'm not my mind, those are limited things, what is...
You're not your body either. Are you?
No.
You're not your mind either, are you?
Is
your body a fixed thing? Is your mind a fixed thing? So it's very interesting to realize that... I should let you finish your question. I'm sorry. I beg your pardon.
There's something about that phrase, like, what is it that's doing this? Because I know my body, my mind is not fixed, constantly changing. And yet, what is it that's doing? What is it that's...
Going to train the mind?
Going to train the mind.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
There is a continuum of consciousness. There is a continuum of body. Is that true? There's a continuum of body? From the time that the sperm and the egg came together in your mother's womb, there was this began a growth process and a continuum, a river of experience, form experience, which this being, this becomes, this being, this becomes, this being, this becomes, this being, this becomes. There is a continuum of mind. This being, this becomes, this being, this becomes, this being, this becomes. Right? There is a continuum of memories. Do you see that? When you are minding your own business, you haven't thought about any, and then all of a sudden somebody says to you, we're going to have a high school reunion. Remember these and send you a bunch of pictures. What happens with your dreams? What happens with your mind? that continuum comes to the fore.
Okay.
Right? There is a continuum. It is not fixed. It is not born like a solid, unchanging lid. This is me. You know? That if you take everything else apart, there it is. Nor is it like that in the mind. Not a solid I who is going to remember this or that. Right? There is a continuum, and there are specific states that do arise conjoined with each other. For example, pleasure will arise with a state of kindliness. Anger will arise with a stronger naming faculty, being able to discriminate, name. Dislike and focus come up together. They always arise together. Right? In the continuum, certain things tend to group together. Did I lose you?
No.
You're thinking about it. Good.
Are you saying that there are basic components that arise together in any continuum of being?
Any being, animal, etc. Any being, when a sense of beauty arises, there is also a sense of kindness. So it's interesting, isn't it? That's what you call the Abhidhamma. It's the list of all the mind states and how they arise, which ones arise conjoined with which, in which conjoined with which, in which circumstances, and which ones are suppressed. And when this one arises, this one doesn't come up. For example, when malice arises, compassion will not arise. Compassion and malice are enemies. When compassion arises, malice will not come up. Right?
Yeah, I could see how that would be impossible.
Now, any mind state arises very quickly and then dissolves very quickly. So what is doing in, and we all know all the mind states. So what one is doing in a practice, like for example, precious human birth, is you're examining and realizing that, you know, in a very crude way, all these mind states are present in me as they are present in all beings. Right? Having examined that, you think, well, when these ones arise, they don't feel so comfortable, and I don't like where they lead to. Right? So the continuum consciousness is quite capable of choosing, opting for pleasure. One of the greatest pleasures we have as human beings is to love. It opens all the doors, so anything is possible. Doesn't it? Orgasm is a very great pleasure in human beings. Have you noticed this? Why is it such a pleasure?
Because it's a certain abandonment.
It's a total abandonment. Of abandoning of what?
Abandoning the things that you cling to normally.
The self-concern.
Yes.
Self-concern.
Yeah.
The greatest happiness you can ever have is if you care for others. If you can do it without suspicion, that's really good. Isn't it?
Isn't compassion very closely linked with understanding?
If you mean by understanding the awareness of that I am not my circumstances, yes, it is. If you don't mean that, then I'm not sure how you mean that. So you'd have to tell me more.
I understand it too. If I look at the struggle, the things that are happening in the East, the present crisis and fear. If you really understood, I think, by examining the conditions.
What conditions?
The conditions that those people are in. They are blind, people are in a confused state, and they're acting, they're being driven and acted upon. They haven't got choices. And Christ said, forgive them, but they know not what to do. So, people
do you understand that it is people who are suffering? Is that what you mean? That there are people?
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say that's true, so long as one can also apply that understanding to all beings, including oneself. But I wouldn't call that so much compassion as I would call that the ability to forgive. And in oneself, the ability to forgive or to confess. Confession that I have done many things due to ignorance. I wouldn't call that compassion, I would call that more regret or confession. Compassion, I think, is something else.
I'm not looking at it that way.
Okay, I misunderstood you.
I'm not looking at the when children are brought up in those conditions, look at them now, the Afghanistan. The drinking water is gone beyond. There is not hope. And you feel yourself in that situation. You can't make any distinction between them and me.
You can't make any distinction? Exactly. I totally agree.
I can't draw any great distinction. I know distinction between me and them.
Yeah.
They're human beings.
Yes, exactly. 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 That's exactly so. Human beings stuck in a trap. Exactly.
You can't help but feel compassion.
No, I think that that's very important, but I don't think See, my problem here, Morris, is not with anything you're saying. My problem is how I understand compassion. compassion is not the same thing to me as being horrified. It is. I don't think one can be compassionate unless one has great faith. I have a young friend who is a protester, for especially against a global business practices. Mm-hmm. And because she herself has been arrested, and she's at the moment barred from protesting until her case is over, what she does is she trains other people how to protest without being provoked, how to be peaceful in protest. She's very, really good at her work, because she isn't interested in provoking anyone. She's interested in having the right to make a statement. Is that clear? She said to me, at the moment I feel the very first time in my heart I dislike any of the legislators or the peacekeepers who stand facing me. I will quit. To me, that's compassion.
Once I feel dislike?
The moment I feel any kind of animosity or dislike or adversity toward the people who are facing me. And she means the people who are in charge of globalization, mm-hmm. as well as the people who are the police, you know, all of it. She says, the moment I feel any kind of animosity, I will quit. To me, that is, I really admire this young woman, because to me that she is walking a very difficult path where compassion is her main practice. She is not in any way trying to change what is. She's very clearly saying, this is what I think we should be doing.
To peacefulness. There has to be some prior state of wanting.
She feels that, as much as we were able to talk about this part of it, and as much as I feel uncomfortable speaking for her, I will go this far. It seems to me that she feels that whatever it is that is driving a lot of the movement toward a global economy, a certain amount of it is blind, and that it is her job to be the eyes for that part, to say there's something we're not looking at here. And she's saying, we. Okay? So that's what she feels her job is. That's her dedication. She feels when she sees people suffering that she has to do what she can do in her neighborhood. Not get angry, but maintain dignity for the benefit of all beings. She feels anger causes blindness. She feels it is not compassionate if there is any sense of being horrified, or that she has to be acting on dignity. To me, she is practicing compassion. She says she needs regularly to go away and spend time by herself, because she can feel overloaded. And when she's overloaded, she tends to get edging toward anger or being horrified. And then she is not valuable, she says. She's a remarkable young woman.
She seems very, very clear.
Well, I think that's compassion. Does that make sense to you then, why I'm making the difference?
Clear is almost understood. You have understanding to be clear.
Well, she knows what she doesn't want to become.
Yeah.
She knows she does not want to become someone who is blind. Who thinks that one right is bigger than another right. So that's her dedication. With compassion.
Not allowing herself to live.
I remember many years ago I was in India, the first time I went to India with my beloved teacher, Namgyal Rinpoche. And it tore me apart. India tore me apart. I was trying to wrestle one guy who pulled those rickshaws into the rickshaw so I could pull it. Because he looked like if he picked it up, he would die, you know? I was crying. I was yelling at my partner at the time, "We're not riding it," you know? Making a real scene. The guy just wanted to make money so he could feed his family. Wasn't interested in my angst. And my beloved teacher came to me and said, "It isn't his suffering you can't stand. It's your suffering, because you're seeing his suffering, that you can't stand." Well, I didn't like to hear that. It started me on a long search. Is it possible to see pain and not react with it, with your hatred to how you're seeing the pain?
Mm-hmm.
That very interesting question, isn't it? It's a very interesting question. Meanwhile, I'm not going to freeze, however imperfectly, You know, now I don't go to India and try to wrestle rickshaw drivers into the seats anymore. Do you understand? And maybe if I was there, I wouldn't do it either. But neither do I close down. But the question always remains, is this compassion or is this trying to get away from the pain I feel? I don't think that there's a right answer to this. I think the question itself is valuable. Not asking the question is somewhere I won't go. Just like my friend, you know, I know where I refuse to go. I refuse to not care. I refuse to not watch the stories, not see the pain. I refuse to turn my back on it. I mean, given that, then I have an ongoing struggle with how to become compassionate for the benefit of all beings. It's not a simple question, is it?
No. I guess a very true narrative. I feel the pain of never as a child visiting some people. And they have beautiful lodging, of course. And I'd be downstairs in the most, with neck caught in a trap, and it was struggling. And I felt horrified pain. And I brought a rocking and knocked them out. Well, the owner of the house was angry because I wrecked the trap. But I look back on it and I see that I felt I couldn't stand the presence of the pain.
Right. And none of us can until we have got touched compassion in ourselves. Until we have compassion for ourselves. What someone else's pain will awaken the pain in myself I have not solved. I have not found the way through. That's the real secret. Is that when I meet pain, any pain in myself that I have not liberated will be vibrating like mad. If I'm afraid of that pain in myself, I will really work hard to try to get rid of it out there. I'll get angry. I'll do all kinds of things. When I have been able to walk through all the hells in my own heart and no longer have any fears from the pains in my own being, I will be compassionate. Haven't got the finished glaze on yet. But I have experienced compassion. I've experienced it from others. I've experienced it in my own heart. And compassion is closer to space than to anything else I know. Space.
Because it's
it is resting in the knowledge of what is permanent and what is not permanent. Because it has perspective. In Calcutta, I couldn't see that guy was happy to get a fare. and what that meant to him for his family. Because I didn't have the space. I just had the pain of him going to pull us. No, no, no. Give him the money. Give him. No. No, he wanted to earn the money. My father had MS. My father was raised to believe that if you didn't work a day in your life, that day you didn't deserve to eat. We have a problem here. He was dying of MS, and he couldn't work. My father went through hell. Then one day, I don't know why, something changed for him. My father was happy looking at a house plant and turning it so it was in the sun more. My father had such joy from sitting and looking out his front yard and seeing the neighbor kids go by. I'm at my parents' house, dropped in for a few weeks. My mother is at work. She phones my father. That really put my father through, that she was working and he wasn't, as you can imagine. Which he also learned. What he did was he started making dinner. She said, "Dear, these people are coming for dinner, old friends. If that's okay, is that okay?" "Oh yeah, fine, fantastic." He goes and he puts potatoes on. He's got everything on. Meat and potatoes. "Hey, Papa, meat and potatoes." And I come along. He's out of the room. I lift the lid. I think we could use maybe one or two more potatoes there. So I peel one or two more potatoes and I put it in the pot. He comes along just when I'm putting last potato in the pot. My father had a really good temper. Hadn't seen his temper for quite a while. I'm like, "God, what's wrong? Who cares if there's not enough potatoes? For God's sake, he put the potatoes in. What's wrong with you, you dumb bitch? Why did you do that to him?" Right? He's like, "Hey, you can't do anything right. What are you? You coming in here? You ruining it." We both go our separate ways. Was that compassionate? I'm sitting there knowing that wasn't compassionate. That wasn't compassionate, was it? I'm not helping him, am I? I don't think so. And fortunately, he told me that. Unfortunately, he was so ill that I hurt him. That when he got angry, I realized that I had not considered him. Right? I had this whole other view about the right way to have a meal. May have been his training, but I wasn't considering him. He could change more than I could. I was 23, he was 62, he was 63. He could change better than me. Interesting, huh? Because he had adapted and had a sense of pride and joy in what he could do. I was too busy fixing it to see who was there. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like suicidal, I should tell you the end of the story. It's a beautiful story. He comes in and he says, "You're mad at me, Sese? Don't be mad at me," he says. He put his arms around me. And we stood there like two little kids, just bobbling on each other's shoulders. And he taught me more about compassion there. Wasn't I fortunate? I said, "I'm not mad at you, I'm mad at me." He said, "Don't be mad at you either. I'm mad at me. Don't be mad at you." And we went on and on. And he died less than 2 weeks later. And we met there. And the biggest thing is he taught me compassion there. Was my first real understanding in depth. To be right is to be wrong. You notice how often I've had to go back to that. How many times so many of you have helped me by teaching me that. You notice what a terrible pain that has been for me this lifetime. To be right is to be wrong. To have an answer because you're trying to avoid something is to be wrong. If you're trying to avoid your own pain or you're trying to avoid a problem, to be right is to be wrong, isn't it? Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's better to not know and keep your mind straight there in your unknowing. Do you think that's true? It feels easier to my wonderful, magnificent ego to have an answer and run as fast as I can. But my magnificent ego does not feel easier. It feels ill at ease, and my level of honesty is lower if I do that. Have you noticed that in yourselves?
Mm-hmm.
It's better not to know so much. Don't you think? Do you think so or not? Not knowing is spacious. Compassion is realizing that you don't have to know and the world still will evolve. And you will learn from the world. Compassion is trusting space. Space means that things move, they change. And my answer, which is usually meant to be an anesthetic, unfortunately, becomes outmoded if I just wait. In the waiting, one practices kindness. One does as much as one is able. Right? In the waiting, one does whatever one can to make sure that there is good water in Afghanistan or in Waterton. Right? Or in Edmonton. Not being exclusive in the waiting. And one also realizes that water is not guaranteed for any of us. So that this moment becomes more precious for me too. So there's a spaciousness to compassion. In the Buddhist teaching, compassion is a very distinct phenomenon. When it is fully developed in the teaching, it becomes spaciousness.
All inclusive.
spaciousness is that all beings are awakening. One of the problems with seeing pain and the horror of that and the wanting to make it stop, you know, that's very strong, isn't it? Wanting to make it stop. Is that our mind freezes on the most horrific picture, doesn't it? So it stays in our minds for a long time, doesn't it? You watch on TV, you know, what do on the papers, what do they do? Get the picture that captures the horror. Doesn't it? Isn't that right? When people are traumatized, isn't it sort of one image that keeps coming back and coming back? Mm-hmm. The traumas in your life, isn't it one image or two or five or seven strung together that come back, right?
They're talking about compassion overload. No, for some years, I've never pictured it in these people.
Yeah. The thing that I'm pointing out about this, as T.S. Eliot also so beautifully pointed out, is in the eye of the observer, that experience is frozen. In the eye of the participant, there have been a series of little steps taking them in and taking them out. In terms of these kinds of horrors, usually. Yes, there are moments in it where trauma is real and profound. But a lot of the things that I see as suffering to somebody else is just business as usual during alterations.
Say that last again.
When I look at someone and I perceive suffering, to them it may not be suffering, it might just be business as usual. If you've spent much time in a hospital, you know the truth of this. When I was in the hospital one time, I was put outside of this room where this person, you know, everybody that I talked to, that I saw, really felt sorry for this guy because he'd had burns over most of it. And you know how painful burns are. And we were all just thinking how brave he was and what a wonderful guy he was. And then one time they were doing something with my roommate, so they put me out in the hall and they just happened to park me outside his room. And I was perfecting one of the talents you learn if you're in the hospital in one bed for 3 months without moving. You become the world's greatest eavesdropper.
That's true.
How long were you? Long time, eh?
6 months.
6 months. So you really got, you pick out footsteps like that. You can hear conversations two houses over. It's amazing how well your ears develop when you're young and interested and you can't move. So I'm listening to the conversation going on. And also because this guy is so brave and he's so amazing, you know? He's so amazing. He's talking to his friend saying, you know, it must be, his friend is saying to him, it must be, I can't imagine what it's like for you here. And this guy is saying, well, you know what, it's not so bad. Well, my ears really. He says, you know, there are people here, and he's talking about this person there that he has such admiration for. Because they've been in, and they have this horrendous, he can't imagine how anybody could deal with what they are working with. And they seem to be, you know, quite just getting along fine. And then I realize he's talking about it.
But I'm not nearly as badly off as you. I mean.
From his eyes, you know. So So how often, when you see something, is it your own sense of what that must be? Or what it really is? Can you actually hear the other person beyond the roar of your own fear or terror? You know? These are real questions to ask in the face of suffering. But those questions shouldn't stop one from doing as much as one is able. It doesn't stop you from acting. But I think it's very important to understand that our reaction to suffering is very strong. We tend to freeze on images and terrify ourselves with them. And it's always worthwhile going into the circumstance as much as you are and saying, "Can I help you?"
The situation gets complicated too when you study the Buddhist design. There's one woman. She'd had a full life. And she taught herself many things. And she was ready to die. And she just wanted not to eat. And to go peacefully. But people didn't want her to. They wanted to pump things into her. She said, I really don't need this. I'm in that group of someone else. I'm ready to go. But people were afraid to face their death.
I'm also afraid of insurance and all kinds of things, Morris. I mean, it's so complicated. Yes. Yeah, that's right.
There are so many situations where the woman wants to keep the man around in the body. Wants Harold to be there.
Yeah.
She's terrified of him.
I spent a lot of time in nursing homes over the last little while, and I know that there is a criteria of care that has to be met by the staff as well, that people are supposed to appear for meals, and you will get up and come to the meal. If you're in a coma or not, you know? That there is a whole level of care with seniors that is really quite specifically... we do want people to be able to eat every day, right? Don't we?
Mm-hmm.
And so if somebody chooses not to eat, and yet the staff is questioned, well, did you get everybody up for a meal? You know, you're right about it, it's very complicated. So what are you going to do? You know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to do when you're in a nursing home, and you decide you don't want to eat anymore? Because you really just want to peacefully let go and send the food to the food bank or something. What are you going to do?
They have to respect that.
Nobody has to respect that.
No. In some cases, they do.
Yeah, in some cases, but very rare, Walter, very rare.
That's a beautiful picture.
Not unless there's a change in the way we do care. For seniors. I mean, we have invisible populations, don't we? We have the three that I know of. Are there more?
Three
invisible populations.
Mm.
Jails, mental institutes, and old age homes.
Mm-hmm.
Are there more than that?
Orphanages.
Hmm?
Orphanages,
yeah.
Homeless people on the street. Too.
Homeless people, right, thank you. Five invisible populations. So we don't even have to look at Afghanistan. I mean, we do. Don't think we don't, but we do. But, I mean, there are five invisible populations here. Aren't there? And how do we react to them in our own city? Isn't that an interesting question? It's a really... There's a sense of unease when you think of those things. Well, what can I do? Those things are all true. What's important is to face that. Not to come up with an answer. From the point of view of meditation, from the point of view of Buddhism, what you do with those states is don't try to get rid of them. Don't try to make yourself holy. Allow them to come up. Let them be there. Be present with them. And then, with that state alive and well, practice your path. The idea in a spiritual practice is not to practice because you're holy. It's because you're not. I'll tell you one thing, the minute you feel good, you'll stop practicing. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Takes a very unusual person to practice when they don't feel discomfort, doesn't it? As long as we can be amused. Somebody started to say something and I cut them off.
I've been becoming aware of this thing of naming your aspirations before you do your spiritual practice. I've sort of an idea of why, but there must be probably more to it. I think it must be pretty important because I sort of got hooked on that.
You're asking me why one would do that?
Well, there must be a lot of significance to that.
Just, it's the same thing that Pat was asking about, why do you choose altruism? Or it's like having realized that spiritual, that the path of experience is more interesting to you, or the vision of experience is more interesting to you than the vision of duality, the impure vision of duality, right? Then you start making choices about what illusions you're going to follow rather than just reacting to circumstances, right? And so you start choosing what it is you aspire to, and you repeat it, and you keep working for it, and you keep that in your mind. So then when it starts coming through, it increases your faith. So then you have more confidence. So when you're asking, then you have less doubt in your request, more faith, and so then that one comes through a little more quickly. And then when you ask for one and it doesn't come through, you don't worry about it so much because you know it's going to come through, and you say, oh, I wonder what is coming through. So that increases your faith. Because it increases your faith, that's why you do it.
Yeah, I kind of thought that maybe it has a means of to focus sort of on.
It is a means to focus, and it also, you see that what you focus on, you get. And so the number one thing is it increases your faith. It gives you more power in your practice.
What if you forget?
There's always an unconscious thing that's going on all the time. For a lot of people, it's that they don't want anybody to interfere with what they're doing. Right? So with their practice, they never talk to anybody else, never do anything, you know? Right? Some people, it's they sit down and their focus is, okay, I don't really want anything to go, I don't really want too much to happen, I just kind of want to have a good time here. And so that's what their practice does. We are always stating an aspiration, whether we think so or not. When you name one, you're being a little more conscious in it. You're acknowledging what is really important to you.
So you can have an array of them. Doesn't always have to be just a general one.
No, yeah, no, you can be very specific. It's helpful, actually, in a way, to be specific, and it's also helpful to repeat it at least for 3 days, and then give it a break for a day, don't repeat any for a day, and then if you want to try another one, try another one. But you don't change it every day, not if you expect results.
Well, I was talking more of doing it before you do your...
Yeah, before you meditate.
Yeah.
Like you sit down.
Because they have that one, like the one that you say...
Namo Tassa.
Yeah. And then I just found out today what it means.
Yeah, I name the state of awakening. Yeah, basically.
So it's good then just so that it's common to do that all the time.
It is really useful.
I can just see myself to trying to do that, but then you kind of just do it as a repetition. There's not, you know, you just...
Repetition has power.
So it's okay to do that too.
Sure. Sweet, yeah. Sure, and then if you add to the repetition some intelligence, that has real power. Uh-huh. If you also have a sense of meaning of what you're repeating, that has even more power. Repetition itself has power. Repetition with some sense of understanding has greater power.
I'm just sort of trying to find out how, like, the importance of it as a practice, you know, part of the practice.
One of the things that it does do is it sort of like sets a limit. Okay, now I am doing my practice, and this is the formula. This is how I do it. Now I start. I name my aspiration. I do the refuge. I create hollow body, and this is my practice. I finish the practice, and I share the merit, then I do a review. And then this whole thing is my practice, so that when you start doing that, that's like creating a clean room in which to entertain friends, so that, you know, last week's laundry doesn't get mixed up with your friend's coats. You know? Or if you're going to serve a meal, have clean plates to serve it on. So last night's dinner doesn't get mixed up with tonight's. Right? Does that make sense to you? It's like clearly saying, okay, this is the focus I'm on now. And all the other stuff is a separate issue. Okay? So when you do that, it's the same as when you meditate. If the room you're in is not neat, then at least the corner you're in should be neat, and you should be facing that corner. Because the mind can settle and feel more relaxed if it's in an orderly environment. So that when you begin to do the practice, then there is a set order to it, then it's easier to relax and go deeper into the practice. The form is set. So then, oh yeah, this is form, this is what I do here. And then the meditation goes deeper. The concentration, the ability to hold the focus, right? They all deepen. Then what you do is you usually alternate with a walking practice. So sitting practice, you're developing concentration of the still mind. Walking practice, you're developing concentration of the moving mind. And they're quite different kind of ways of being concentrated. Does that answer you?
So will you just try to fit it in? I mean, what walking and
walking meditation is a specific formula too, but you're walking.
Yeah.
And there are lots of different ways of doing walking meditation.
But today we usually drive, though. I hardly ever walk.
Don't you?
Yeah.
Might be interesting for you to do a walking meditation for 10 minutes every day.
Instead of just sitting down, like getting out, go out and do a walking meditation set.
Sure, or walk from one room to the other, or you know, but for 10 minutes, walk. So you walk. And you can walk and say mantra, or you can do a slower walk. There's lots of ways to do walking practice.
So not just sitting.
It's nice to do both.
Yeah.
Don't you think, Andrea? Really, they do bring a different way of concentrating. They're both very useful. And it's very nice to learn both and pay attention to both. It's worth a try.
Yeah.
Andrea knows lots of walking meditations. If you let her know what meditation you're doing, she could probably tell you one that would go real well with what you're doing. That would augment the sitting practice you're doing. Do you walk from the street to the house after you park your car?
Well, I go across the yard.
So there you go.
Shortest way.
Right. So while you're walking there, you could be doing some kind of practice.
Yeah, but usually there's no space there for that.
What, from across the yard?
Well, because
10 steps,
so
isn't it?
Much stuff has been kicked into gear by that time that...
That maybe you should kick a walking meditation into gear. Seems to me that's one more gear. We could take this a long way if we really got into the clutch. Could become quite a shifty conversation. We could all get very tired.
See, because right now I'm just doing, like, focusing on breath and that, and so this whole thing of this naming your aspiration or something just didn't do a whole lot of that. But I mean,
but it's interesting to explore it, isn't it? To see what happens if that, if you do that. I mean, you're going to be sitting there anyway.
That's almost like verbalizing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if you sort of have that in mind anyway, so.
But there is a little more power if you specifically verbalize, this is my aspiration. There are three levels of karma. Action. Mind. Speech. And body. Something, some action of the mind happens many, many times, and eventually it makes it to a verbalization, either silent or many, many mental actions create a verbal action. Many, many verbal actions create a physical action. You want to be generous, and then you start by imagining yourself generous. So many, many thoughts of thinking of yourself as generous, eventually you'll actually say something generous. Many moments of saying something generous, next thing you know, you're going to be doing something generous. It starts with verbalization in the mind, and then it becomes verbalization with the tongue, and then it's verbalization with the body. But you knew that anyway, didn't you? You've seen things move from a thought to an action, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
So. So now what you would be doing is choosing which things are moving, not just sort of letting them just come in haphazardly based on circumstance and, you know. Become proactive rather than reactive. Isn't that the way you say that these days?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Love to be updated. Is that reasonable?
Well, what I'm thinking about, then, if that is a really good thing to do, then you could. What I read was that this was said since Buddha time, 500 years ago, so that's why they sort of do it.
What, name an aspiration or say,
yeah.
Namo Tassa?
Yeah.
Say Namo Tassa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or doing the, or even following a procedure. I don't know, I guess I'm just sort of trying to zero in to do something really personalized in there.
Which is wonderful. I mean, at various times, I take a specific aspiration and name it. Especially, for example, when I noticed that I wasn't spending enough time listening to my mama when she was still alive. And I would do Namo Tassa because I name the state of awakening, that's how I start something. And then I would sit there for a moment, I would do. I would think about what I was doing. Okay, I'm going to meditate now, and now I aspire to actually hear the people I am with. I'd say that. And then I would do the rest of my practice. Very personal, very straightforward. And I found that very useful way to work. Because you get what you ask for.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so you can carry it a little farther if you want to, than just being so.
Well, Namotasa is like, I name the state of awakening. That's why I'm here. I'm here because I name it. I believe in it. And now, personally, I aspire to be more able to hear people.
So that sort of really like lets you know that you are really on the path.
What, Namotasa?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is what I'm doing here. I'm here, I name the state of awakening, and that's what I'm here for. That's a very condensed, shortened way of describing what Namotasa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa means, but it's okay. Gives an indication of where it lies anyway.
How do we know how to name our aspiration? Because we may think we have an aspiration, but it could take us another way. Like, you know, if you...
Maybe your aspiration then is, I wish to be more confident in knowing what I want. Maybe that's your aspiration. Whatever your question is your aspiration.
Like you said, I think last month, something about a man who wanted peace and quiet or something. I can't remember exactly what it was, and now he's got
but
cancer.
But to him, he's had cancer for a while, and he's wanted peace and quiet for a very long time. To him, peace and quiet meant nobody bothering him. It didn't mean being able to take things that bother me and find the joy in them. Right? So he wasn't actually asking for peacefulness. He was asking to get away. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not sure that you trust your aspiration, then maybe that's your aspiration. May I be sure about my aspiration? You know? Don't you think that's reasonable?
Mm-hmm. And how many times a day do we say our aspiration? Like, is
when
it something?
When you sit. When you sit.
Just when you sit. So you don't, it's not like a mantra that you repeat a lot. It's
you could do that, but I don't think you need to. I think that tends too much toward anxiety.
Okay.
You know? It's too much like marching down the road. You need enough power to ask a question and enough relaxation to get an answer. If you're continuously knocking on the door, whoever's trying to open it won't do it because they'll get hit in the face. You have to sit back and wait, you know. Oh, hi! And that's the value of being a human, is that there's enough difficulty to really ask a decent question, like, what am I doing wrong? And enough space so the answer comes.
This!
okay. And then it's up to us to be happy about the answer, you know? I mean, just as many people have had an aspiration and asked for it and had it come through. I've had every aspiration I've ever had in my life, to, with the exception of a couple of the biggies, have come through right by now. And the biggies are on their way. I can feel them. But, you know, the impossible things have all happened. things I never thought would happen in my life have all happened. And not because I made a battle plan, but because I had the aspiration, and then I made the aspiration, and then I got on with what was in front of me. I didn't try to make the aspiration a reason why I couldn't be present with what there was.
Lasting.
That you have to make the aspiration and then drop the fact, acknowledge that you've made that aspiration, drop it, and get on with accepting what's in front of you. What is in front of you? Because, you know, everything that's in front of you, it has something to do with aspirations made in the past. You have to clean it up, you know, get it moving. So there's space for what you're asking for to come. It'll come. Life is trustworthy, as well as difficult. It's very interesting, and I recommend to you the idea of taking everything that arises in your life as a gift. And see how you want to use it. And some gifts you want to just pass on to somebody who they suit better. Don't they? Don't you? That's okay. That's honoring the gift. Isn't it? Anyway. Is this an adequate sufficiency for this evening? Yes, sir.
The book that you were reading out of last night, can you tell me what the name of it is?
Lamdre.
Yeah.
L-A-M-D-R-E. Somebody called it laundry last night.
That's good. L-A-M-D-R-E. Is it from Chagall?
Do you want me to show it to you? So you can write down its publisher at home?
The thing on, I think on Thursday night, you talked about a practice that you had that might be beneficial to us. You wanted it. It was a short practice, a prayer. Do you remember?
I don't. Was that Thursday night? Was Buddha night?
Yeah.
And was in relation to what? Did I say that?
You said you want to stretch your name down. I'll send it to you next time I come down.